This is the Let's Go Win podcast with your host, J.M. Ryerson.
Hey, what's happening, you guys? Welcome back to the Let's Go Win podcast. We have a dynamic couple today, a mother-daughter team, and they are absolutely going to blow your minds with stories and leadership. Dr. Ann Dranitz-Saris and Heather Dranitz-Saris-Hilliard, a mother-daughter team, are organizational and leadership development experts at Caliber Leadership Systems, a boutique consulting firm specializing in dismantling dysfunction. They're dedicated to empowering individuals, leaders, and organizations to achieve their potential by leveraging their expertise in the neurobiology of human development combined with system thinking approach. Anne and Heather have worked with thousands of leaders and individuals from around the world, been featured in dozens of publications, spoken at professional conferences, and written several series of books on personality type and the brain based on the striving styles and MBTI. Dr. Anne, Heather, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thanks for having us. We're so excited to be here today.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's truly my pleasure. And I guess one of the things that sticks out to me in that introduction is dismantling dysfunction. And I cannot wait to get into that because I think there's a little bit of that in the world. But I would love to hear, your guys' story of how y'all came together to build this, because leadership's so important in our world. And you've been doing this work for the better part of past two decades now. So talk to me the story of you guys coming together and building this amazing, team and company and all the amazing, profound work that you've done.
So when Ann and I first met, we were living in opposite sides of the country, and, my work was focused in organizations where we were trying to change culture, we were trying to change behavior. And Anne was doing work individually with clients in her coaching practice and her psychotherapy practice. And both of us sort of had this interesting experience of where I was trying to get behavioral change by putting in new systems like performance management and, you know, competencies. And she was working with clients who were struggling because of the dynamics at work and wasn't able to get traction in affecting change in those dynamics. And so when we looked at sort of what we were both doing and thought, wow, this is really cool, what if we put it together? Because organizational dysfunction was so pervasive, as it continues to be today. That's why we like to say that as experts in dysfunction, we have no shortage of client organizations to work with. But it was really sort of this combining up of sort of thinking about things through that lens of how do you really create function in organizations when we're throwing so many human beings together who aren't necessarily equipped with navigating some of those interpersonal and organizational challenges that they face.
No, it's beautiful. And one of the things you said, and again, I off camera, we had a brief discussion. You said when we met. Now, again, mother-daughter team have a unique story, and I absolutely want to share it. I think it's inspirational. I think so many people. So talk to me about that, because you said when we met. Well, your mother-daughter, you've known each other.
What's up with that?
So what's the story there, girls?
Used to be my secret shame that I had a daughter when I was 16 that I gave up for adoption. But, you know, to my great delight, I had a reunion. Delight's a very small description for what I felt at our reunion. But when Heather was 27, we reunited and very, very soon found that we had so much in common. And obviously, you know, there is that nature nurture debate that goes on. But, you know, in our case, it really worked for us because we had so many like-minded ideas, our approaches to people, our approach to development, and not seeing performance or human behavior as a static thing, but as something that it, when examined, one can develop, one can move people in the direction of their potential by identifying what that potential looks like and then, you know, how they've strayed from it into dysfunction. And so after 2.5-3 years, Heather and I decided that we were going to work together. and create our own business, bringing those two sides, the systems and people, together to provide powerful results in organizations.
Wow. Well, let me just say, regardless of work that you guys have done, which is fascinating, I cannot wait to dig into it. That is remarkable. And that you said nature versus nurture. I assume we're going to talk a little bit about this, because are leaders born, are leaders built, right? There's some controversy or dialogue happening around that. But I love the fact that, again, separated, I guess would be the word, for those years, 27 years, and then to realize, oh my gosh, we have these kindred spirits and soul, and we're going to not only reunite, we're going to work together. We are going all in. Heather, what was kind of your experience? Because again, there's challenges. My best friend was adopted, and there's challenges with, when you are adopted, and sometimes it's not easy to just reunite with those people. But obviously, it was an amazing reunification.
reunification.
Was a good what was kind of your experience?
Well, I think it was different because I didn't go into it looking for a replacement for my adoptive mother. And I went into it looking for information out of a place of real curiosity, and that was what probably hit me, that when in sort of those first experiences of, wow, she sounds like me. Wow, we have similar mannerisms. Wow, there are people who look like me in the world. So you navigate through all of that. But I think because Anna and I connected so much around this work that we were both here to do around helping people, helping organizations achieve potential, that we were both so fascinated by this and driven by this. And there've been many times over the course of our working career where I've said, well, she just gave birth to me to have sort of another pair of hands to go out and do this work in the world. Right. So, many ways, sort of this extension of her, we have different personalities, but we work so, complete, it's like we complete in a way, right? Because her skills and gifts are different than mine. And by combining them together, we've been able to have a much bigger impact than either one of us ever would have been able to do on our own. Yeah. So there's sort of this fascinating piece of it but we had to grow through it. And to your point, not an easy journey, because you are building a relationship, you're sort of navigating in this unusual space and becoming business partners at the same time. So you're building a familial connection, a friendship, a business relationship. And so we've had, sort of ups and downs like everybody does. But I think what has been really interesting for Anna and I is that, again, it's our nature sort of brought us to this point, but our development and our continuous pursuit of sort of learning and growing as humans, which is what we bring into the work that we do in organizations, has been what's allowed us to be so successful and get to this point with it.
It's beautiful. And what's so cool is I love the way you said that. It's kind of amazing, because now you have you have two moms at this point. You have two people that are really, able to look out for you. You've been so blessed in that way. And I love the way you look at that. So let's get into a little bit. So empowering leaders and individuals past their dysfunctional behavior. You've written a couple books on this. And I think one of them is So You Think You Can Lead. How do we empower leaders to do this? Because there's a little bit of, as we said, dysfunctional behavior out there.
Well, and particularly in this environment that we're in now, where leaders are actually feeling less empowered than they did previously, because more is expected of them from the human side of leadership, but there is still an absence of leaders being developed around how to lead people. And so Heather and I talk about this a lot, of how do we get leaders to stop doing and actually make time and spend time leading their people, because it's something that they do not as a priority. It's something that they do when they can squeeze in the time. And quite often leaders will say, well, I had to cancel this meeting and I had to cancel again, and I really don't have time for it. I know I should, but it's easier to just to keep doing the management side of their job and not give that up, because they don't know how to lead. They've never been taught. They don't have the interpersonal skills, or even in some cases, the desire to actually lead their people. They want to lead their function. They don't necessarily want to lead people. And so there's this huge gap combined with the expectations of employees now for things like psychological safety and manage my stress and sit down and listen to me when I talk about all of my issues. And, you know, exaggerating a little bit, but just a little bit, because some of the stories that our leader clients tell us about, I spent an hour and a half talking to a client who's or an employee that's really going through a hard time. And because they don't know how to boundary it, they just don't even know how to say something as simple as, I'd love to be able to spend more time with you, but, you know, this is out of my area of expertise, you know, and send them to HR so that they can actually be referred to someone. And so they move into a role that they really aren't prepared to tackle.
Yeah. So you brought up a couple of things there that I want to dig into. But one of the things that I've really been exploring is human beings versus human doings. And one of the things you said is these leaders are doing. And as a leader, it's really a presence. It's really a being. It's something that is all the time, right? Being a leader is not like you get to turn it on and off like a light switch. You're a leader. You're in it. Is that a fair statement to make?
Yeah. And I think one of the things I talk about too, is this notion that, you know, leading, it's a verb, right? To lead, you know, and what we see is leaders who are not actually doing the activity of leading, right? And as a result of that, they create these vacuums, what we call an authority vacuum, right? Where, you know, employees do what they feel like doing. And you know, the leaders are really self-protective in their interactions with their employees. And it's more about how they look or how they're perceived by their employees. And, you know, am I a nice guy? Or am I a great gal? Am I, you know, sort of keeping my employees happy became sort of more of that focal point for a long time there, where, you know, there were books coming out crazy about how leaders, their job was to keep employees happy. And so because the leaders are not equipped with sort of navigating through the emotional realities that go on in the workplaces, they get really permissive and they get really tolerant. And then they're abdicating that role of leading. And that's where we see that trying to get them back out of, and, you know, if I stay here and I do all my work and I, you know, I make sure that I'm really functional in that way, then it makes me feel safe. But again, it means nobody's really in there and having the presence to lead in the organization. And that's where the dysfunction starts to emerge, right? As soon as there's nobody defining and directing and, you know, setting the course and holding people accountable, it's the dysfunction naturally emerges, because, you know, you put humans together and dysfunction's a kind of a normal byproduct of that process, right?
Yeah, no doubt about it. There's, as you said, there's no shortage of dysfunction. But one of the things that continues, you guys continue to say, is development, lack of training, lack of. So clearly there is a feeling that there is a way to develop as a leader. And I have my own system. I had mentors. I've read a ridiculous amount of books, and then trial and error. So that was all part of my leadership path. How do we tackle, ladies, helping leaders develop so we don't have as much dysfunction, as much as I always want you to have a good place in the world and think you're safe there? But how do we get more leaders? And maybe this is the education you're bringing to the world. How do we get more leaders to get developed? Where does that all start?
It starts with leaders actually considering leadership to be a profession. It is the mindset. It has to do with the mindset that we start out with, that if I'm not just managing, and so you there are those levels, there are all kinds of different levels in organizations, but those people that are at the top, as Heather said, who are defining, who are directing, who are really making it clear what success looks like and what has to happen in order for success to be achieved, they're the ones that have to start with, you know, why aren't I getting the results that I want? Or some basic education around who am I? Who am I, the person who is leading? And what are my strengths? What are my blind spots? How is it that, you know, I tell people what to do and the next thing you know, they're doing something very different? And why does that keep happening? They have to step out of judging themselves into assessing how they're performing as a leader against an objective criteria. There is so much subjectivity around, again, as Heather mentioned, the good leader. And there are articles abound on the internet about five things you have to do to be a great leader, a good leader. And it's like, no, it's a daily practice of how am I meeting my employees? How am I holding the boundaries? How am I holding people to account and making sure that all energies are aligned with the organizational outcomes? And that's not about being good. It's about being effective.
Yeah. And you've said the word boundaries a couple of times now. And so clearly defining boundaries, holding those, yet bringing the human side of things. So it's this really interesting world, especially in the W-2, because you mentioned HR. I want to show compassion. I need my boundaries. There's a lot going on here because I can't say the right thing. I don't want to say the wrong thing. How do I do this and define these boundaries? So Anne, Heather, what some thoughts there? Because right now I'm going, okay, I get it. We've got to set boundaries. We've got to be compassionate, but I can't be an HR disaster. What do I do?
Well, I think part of it is going back to this notion of, and we talk to our clients a lot about this, is what am I entitled to as a leader, right? And because leaders have lost that sense of this is what I'm entitled to in terms of exercising authority and giving direction. Like we hear it from our clients all the time where, well, I can't say that to my employees, or I can't set expectations for them, or they're going to accuse me of micromanaging. And so it all of that gets in the way of actually being able to show up and be able to say, you know, here are the rules that all members of my team, like that's a boundary, right? All members of my team must follow these rules. And the rules can be about meeting deadlines. It can be about, you know, communicating up front if they're going to miss a deadline. Like even that's what we mean when we talk about boundaries, that what are the expectations that hold us and allow us to function effectively together? And a lot of the leaders these days are too afraid to draw those lines in the sand. And well, what if the employees won't like it, or they're not going to like me imposing rules on them? And it's like, but that's your job as the leader. And in the absence of that, then we have employees acting like they have more authority, making decisions to do things however they feel like it, you know, feeling like they can come to their manager and sort of, you know, dump whatever's going on in their lives on them. And that rendering what the leaders do in that process, because they don't have any boundaries, they often end up taking work over for their employees, coming in to rescue their employees at the last minute, or really rendering themselves ineffective. Because even like part of boundary setting is as a leader is recognizing when you've got more work than you and your team can handle and coming up with a resource plan or some sort of plan to move out of chaos into some degree of stability. And those are the kinds of things that we're talking about when we use a term like boundary. It's really, you know, everything from kind of setting some ground rules through to making sure you actually have a plan and you're executing against that plan.
Well, and would you guys agree that most dysfunction comes from lack of setting expectations? What am I actually supposed to do? What is my role in this whole deal? Like, if I don't know where I'm supposed to be going, I got a job description, but you're not telling me what you expect of me. Isn't that where a lot of this dysfunction comes in the first place?
Absolutely. And this is the number one reason why leaders with that mindset of, oh, I have to allow my employees to be creative and innovative, and they know what they know better how to do it, and I have to let that happen, as opposed to showing them what success looks like, so that as they go out, they're at least coloring within the lines. You see, and so by attending more to their emotions and how they're going to feel about themselves, they're actually impeding their employees' success. They think that they're doing the better thing for employees, and it's not helpful to let an employee make a whole bunch of mistakes and then have to manage them through, you know, correcting them and how that employee is going to feel when they find out they did it wrong.
So I'm going to venture, you said the word empower for your leaders, but isn't the job as a leader to also empower their employees, their team members, to thrive in the position that they do, not be micromanaged, set the expectation and let them run the way? Is that Is that the idea as a leader? Because that was certainly always my goal, is I want to empower these people to do it way better than I do. That's why you're on my team.
Yeah, but I think what's happened, though, is this notion of empowerment, the definition of it in organizations has changed. And so empowerment means you are totally hands off and you leave your employees to do whatever it is your employees want. When we talk about empowerment, it is exactly that first step that's so important that a lot of leaders are skipping these days, which is the defining what does success look like here. We have a client we're working on this right now as it relates to quality. And this is an organization that has a very, very high commitment to quality and everybody knows it, but there's complete misalignment across the functions. There's silos around quality. There's arguing over what is it good enough or is it quality and what's the and what they were missing in that empowering. So they let everybody kind of go off and running under this blanket notion of quality, but there was no definition of, well, what does that mean? What does quality look like here? So when we say quality, what are some guiding principles that everybody can use? Because what was happening was each employee was deciding whether or not it was in their mind, it was quality. And there was no alignment. And you can't empower people without putting the structure, the boundaries, the framework, whatever you want to call it, where everybody's clear on what success looks like at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So it sounds like if we slow down in the beginning, we actually set up some proper expectations, what the goal is, where we're going, what are the ground rules, how are we going to have, as you said, psychological safety, trust within our team. And then one of the things Heather said off air is, you know, kind of equal speaking time. I know Google did a whole study on this. The most effective teams in the world have those three things: psychological safety, trust, and equal amount of speaking time in meetings. That's not how a lot of these organizations are run. Let's just be honest. I've been in a lot of meetings and it's certainly not equal speaking time. And I don't think there's a lot of psychological safety happening. So is it as easy as setting up these expectations that's going to allow that? How can leaders build on trust and so their team can have that safety?
These generic terms like psychological safety or even trust, that trust really, building trust is something that if you said to any leader, well, how do you build trust? They might say, well, I talk to my people. I let them, you know, have their way. I give them, you know, but leaders need to understand, you know, that psychological safety comes out of knowing certain things and predictability and knowing the difference between when a leader is going with their own agenda, trying to empower their employees, as opposed to setting up the circumstances for their success, which is more about what is an employee need and giving each employee what they need and not looking at employees as one size fits all, because you know, some employees like real specific detailed instruction, otherwise they get anxious, and others don't. And so it's understanding and really getting to know what each of the employees needs, and that the employee is able to trust that the leader will be there for them the way they need them to be, not the way the leader wants to be. Because as you said in the beginning, in that first question around, you know, what do leaders need to do to develop, they actually need to get to know their people. And that's one of the key ways of building trust, and not expecting that every employee is going to want the same thing. And every employee is going to want to be, quote unquote, empowered and left to their own devices.
Yeah, so there's not one size fits all. That's clear. And one of the things, gosh, I'm hearing some of the things your clients are saying, and I get it. I've worked with a lot of leaders. People want to have their way or to like. I look at being a parent. Look, my kids have psychological safety, but I'm not trying to be their friend all the time. Let's be clear about this. I want them to like me. That's great, but that's not my job. That's not my role. And so it's just so interesting. I don't know where that began, where people wanted it to be always like, because obviously we've shifted from the 70s to the 80s to the 90s to now. Oh, yeah. I mean, leadership is ever evolving. You can't do what you did back in the 90s today and be successful. It's just different. That's pretty That's pretty obvious, isn't it? Is that what you all are seeing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But, and what we talk about is we, you know, we had that autocratic, you know, high authoritarian style for, you know, quite a few decades in there. And that was functional in many ways. And then all of a sudden we went through this transition where leaders became permissive. And this is what we talk to and train our clients around a lot, is really understanding when they're working out of that self-protective approach of being permissive, where, and that is driven by, you know, to a degree, you know, sort of ego needs. It's, I want to be liked and I want to be seen in a particular way, but when we're dealing with leaders who are operating out of that permissive persona, is they're not actually leading, and they're often not comfortable with exercising the authority of their role, right? And this is where you see, even on an executive team, if you've got a CEO who's being permissive, then the loudest voice in the room starts to dominate, and you get these, you know, individuals, you know, using different strategies to try and be the one who steps into that, you know, power vacuum. And so the power dynamics at play that start to emerge become really problematic for the organization. But you think about permissive as from a leadership perspective is, you know, I'm not setting expectations. I'm not holding my people accountable. And I can still be really successful. Like, we have really successful client organizations that have really dysfunctional executive teams. And so it's not that dysfunction means that the company can't be successful, but certainly the organization might not be as successful. It might not be hitting its stride of potential, or it's painful for the people that are in it because they're sort of living out of that dysfunction. But so we talk a lot about sort of just moving. We're not saying move back to that autocratic style, but let's take the pieces of that autocratic style that's really productive from a leadership perspective, directing, governing, holding people accountable, and combine it with the permissive, more people-centric approach where, you know, we attend to and work on the development. But we as leaders, we have to develop, and talked about getting to know the team, but also from a self-awareness perspective as leaders, really understanding our natural leadership style, how we're hardwired to lead, and starting to develop up the emotional intelligence so that we can navigate, be aware of when our feelings, our emotions are causing us to step out of leading and causing us to give away our power or disempower ourselves. I mean, we have lots of leaders who talk as though they're powerless to actually do anything about their employees. And that's that permissive sort of model that we're always trying to help our clients move back out of into something that's more balanced and ultimately more effective from a leadership perspective.
Yeah. And I'm excited to get this next one, because I've been a part of dysfunctional executive teams who won despite the dysfunction. Yeah. And I've been part of amazing executive teams that won despite not having as much talent. And it was a hell of a lot more fun. And the word I'm going to use, and I know it's extremely overused, but it's such an important word if you get it defined. And that's culture for me. Once we defined culture, at least for my executive teams, when we were clear on who we are, what we stand for, what we allow, what we don't allow, the non-negotiables versus the way it, once we set those up, girls, it was like, you know, everything just opened up and it was fantastic. Is that a big part that is missing in leadership, is just getting clear on what our cultural values are, who we are, what we stand for?
But in some organizations, absolutely. Some leaders go into a new role leading a team and don't even realize or recognize that it's their authority to create a team charter or decide what their team or how their team is going to function together. But it's not always as hard for a leadership group to define those things. What's more difficult is the accountability side of it and driving it down through the organization and expecting that next level leadership team to really walk the talk and embrace it and embed it in their own teams. Heather, you might want to say a bit more on that one.
Yeah, I'm laughing because I'm thinking about a client where they've done exactly that. You know, they did a great job. They defined, you know, sort of the culture they wanted, the values, they're plastered all over the wall. And then they sit around in their executive meetings complaining because the tier of leaders below them aren't demonstrating that they aren't working to kind of fill that gap. And this is where you've got leaders who they can see it and they can understand and they can do the right things, but then they don't want to stay involved with bringing moving that next tier along, right? And really, you know, staying involved in everything from, you know, in this particular client, they just said, well, we told them what we wanted them to do. We just expect them to do it, right? It's like, okay, now you have to go in and you have to work with them because you just can't expect them to be at the same level as you. And so that's another place where we see a big gap. And you had asked this question earlier about, you know, from a development perspective and what gets in the way is when we have leaders at the top who have not gone through the process of self-development as a leader, they then just look at everybody else to magically, because they're in that leadership role, to be able to be fully functional. And they don't want to invest their time or effort in working the folks up into that level and developing them up. And so there's a big gap there. And because they haven't had to develop, they say, well, I got here without any development, so therefore nobody else around me should have any development. So again, we stay in this cycle. So we absolutely agree with you. Culture is like the flip side of the coin from leadership. But again, if you don't know how to lead out into your organization to drive that culture, then it's just going to stay on the wall.
Yeah. Bad news, guys. You can't just put it on a poster and be like, okay, this is what we are. That's not the way it works. You might have to talk about it. In fact, yes. Every single meeting, that's how we started.
You got it.
Values that we had. Okay. I want to get into the personality assessments because you guys have built one, is my understanding. And I've taken lots of assessments, some good, some, I don't know. It's a lot of information overload, quite honestly. What are y'all seeing with your assessment? How does that give an organization a leg up, whether it's in leadership, the executive team? What is it doing for you guys? Because I'm all in. I believe in them, but I haven't always seen them be as effective as I would like.
The biggest problem, just to speak to that lack of effectiveness, is that it's not a one and done. A lot of organizations have been doing it just in terms of team building. You know, we have this one day, we all figure out what our personality type is, and then, you know, we go away and we forget our four-letter code or whatever it is. But, you know, Heather and I evolved the Striving Styles personality system out of our frustration with leadership assessment, because we were using three assessments. At one point, we were using the Myers-Briggs, we were using the EQI, emotional quotient inventory, as well as another leadership assessment on leadership strengths. And so what we did was we combined this to make it a bit more user-friendly, still working with Jung's psychological functions and evolving the Myers-Briggs to where it connected with emotional needs, the emotional drivers of behavior, and not just the behavior themselves. And then wrote our leadership reports around that. And what we do is we facilitate our leadership development programs, starting off with the style and embedding it into each of the modules that we teach. And then we come up with suggestions for whatever the client organization is in ways that they can use it to understand their people. And because in So You Think You Can Lead, we talk about the stages of performance development, where if you don't know what your employees need, you're going to be leading out of your own style. And if that style is, I'm giving you information, letting you run with it, you're going to miss the boat on a good number of your employees, you see. And so the more you understand the style of your people, it fast tracks everything. And that's one of the big sellers of this is if you understand that you have a need to be secure, you're going to resist change like crazy. And so as a leader, how do you work with yourself so that you don't get in the way of your own growth and the growth of your business? Because once you've hit the status quo, then all there is to do is stagnate if you want to stay secure. And so that's just one example that we can use to make it live for our leaders and our clients, in understanding how useful this can be.
Well, I imagine when you do it, and I'm sorry, Heather, if you had something, but I just imagine you do these assessments. There's got to be times where you're looking at the person that was assessed and looking at the role that they're in, and you're going, nope, this is not a good fit. Is that something that comes up frequently? And how do your clients receive that? Because ultimately, we want the right people in the right seat on the bus. That's the hope. but it's not always that way, especially as you come up in a smaller business. Everybody's wearing all sorts of hats, but it doesn't mean it was the right fit. So are you seeing that with some of the assessments?
We do, but I, if we go back to sort of part of the reason why Anne created this is that, you know, yes, we want to understand the why people behave the way they did, but more importantly, what does it mean developmentally and how do we solution it based on our personality style? And so if we have a situation like that, that you're talking about, where when we look at their brain style, we'd be like, probably not the ideal fit, but they're there. So how do we make it work? So we can look at what are some systems that need to go around them? Who do they need to have on their team? What do they need from their direct manager? So if, for example, if I look at someone who's feeling preferenced, we know planning, which is part of the thinking function, is not their strength. It's the opposite. So it's going to be their weakest area. So as a leader, if you don't have a natural inherent ability to plan, and that's a core part of leading, then what do we do about it? And how can we support that person either through development activity, through pairing them with someone else who's stronger at planning? So we can problem solve a lot of it. And the other thing we talk about is stop expecting employees. So if we look at it from a leader employee, is stop expecting them to do that. Going back to the one that Anne talked about, if they have a need to be secure and they want it to be status quo, don't go to them with a blank sheet of paper and say, come up with 10 new options for me. Their brain doesn't do that. What you can do to that person is take them with some options that you've come up with and ask them to tell you why it's not going to work. They're incredibly gifted at that. So you start looking at how we use people, how we employ them, or, you know, really activate them in a way that is actually getting the best of them. While at the same time, we still need to develop, especially as leaders, we need to develop up our whole brains. And so if we're only working out of one or two parts of our brain, it really limits our ability to be ultimately effective as leaders. And that's where, you know, what one of the things that I love about our system is that we can actually put together development plans aimed at creating new neural pathways to the parts of the brain that they're not accessing as, or are not as well developed. And they can actually build up, you know, like a muscle, that ability to tap into those talents and abilities that are rooted in that particular part of the brain.
Yeah, we haven't even really dove in on some of the neurobiology, which is shocking because I'm fascinated by it. But you guys did provide one question. I rarely ask the given questions, but this was written so well, I have to ask it. And it is, people try to fix things about them they don't like, or try to fix others so they like them more. Why doesn't this approach work? Because I think this is a question not only for business. We are talking marriages. We are talking all kinds of partnerships, every relationship. Girls, help us out. Help the whole audience. This might be the most important one of the day.
So if I'm coming at my partner trying to fix him, what I'm actually saying is, you're not behaving the way I want you to behave, so I'll feel the way I want to feel. So we have developmental delays as human beings. We're not broken. We always talk about it as being stalled, and we need to pick up where our parents left off relative to our development. It's our responsibility. But if we think of ourselves as broken, you see, and needing to be fixed, we're more likely to feel some embarrassment or shame around it and not get help for it, or try and work around it and try and hide it, or not do things that will make us feel incompetent in that area. And so behavior doesn't have to be fixed. It needs to be developed. And when we create competency models, for example, we do really clear, this is what the desired behavior looks like. This is what it doesn't look like. It doesn't mean that you're broken or you need fixing if you are demonstrating those behaviors, but you definitely need to start working on a few of the desired behaviors. So you take it out of that language of what's wrong with you. You see, the non-judgmental approach moves us into development, and the acceptance of new information or trying new things, and just getting people into that growth mindset that really is required. Because when you're in a fixed mindset, it's easy. Well, I'm broken. You know, I can't do anything about it. This is who I am. This is just me. You can't change me. And it's like, no, we're not trying to change anyone fundamentally, but we have a choice as to what behaviors we use in any given situation. And the more tools that we have and the more conscious we are around these things, the more effective we become as leaders.
I love it. Heather, anything to add there? Because it's a big question. So
it used to be one of my favorite things when Ann and I actually would start working together. And I'm like, well, just tell me how to fix it. Then we get to be like, okay. So I think one of the problems with that mindset too, and we talk about this a lot with clients, is it leads to this magic bullet thinking, which is, well, if I just get the right person, if I just get that, you know, if I just swap this person out, or, and that's not the way it works, because again, as human beings, we're all going to come into our roles with some limitation as a result of our conditioning, as a result of our personality. And every time you look at trying to fix it, and if it doesn't get fixed the first time out, we hear these things like, well, I had the conversation with them and nothing changed. And as opposed to looking at it as a process that requires time and nurturing and, you know, consciousness, as Ann said, and that allows us to kind of grow and develop. And individuals have to actually set some goals for themselves around their own development, if it's going to happen, right? And so if I try and fix, you know, my partner, he's just going to resist it, right? Whereas if he says, look, this isn't serving me, or I can see that I would get a better benefit if I did it that way, then again, it's more directive. And we're not trying to fix something. We're just trying to achieve something in our lives that we want, that's going to allow us to be more satisfied, to feel like we're moving towards our potential, or, you know, whatever it is kind of the driving force behind it. But yeah, then the notion of fixing just, it doesn't work.
Even the way you said that I even if I was your guy, I got permission to get better is kind of how I heard that. Permission to get better. Ladies, I can't believe it. We're almost out of the interview. I want to give you open form real quick for anything I didn't have time to ask. Just your anything you want to make sure you share with the audience that I didn't know enough to ask.
Well, one of the things, and just connecting to the last question, is when we look at changing and developing our behavior, it's sort of the equivalent of our automatic behavior is like a superhighway. And the new behaviors, it's like, you know, going through a jungle with a machete, you know, trying to carve out a path. And in order to get a new behavior to be that go-to behavior, we have to consciously set a time frame for it, because it's very easy to go back on the superhighway. The neural pathways just go that way. And for people to have patience with their own development and not get in their own way and sabotage themselves by thinking that they should be changing or doing things differently faster.
That's a wonderful analogy. And there's not a sharp enough machete. You're just going to a little bit. Heather, anything for you that you want to add in before we kind of get to the last part of it?
Yeah, I think my last thought is just that when we look at our own development, and this is where Anna and I always talk to our clients about this, is we don't just go out and teach our clients this or work with them. Anna and I have actually practiced all of this on ourselves. We refer to our personal life as a bit of a petri dish, right, where we did the experimentation. But we wanted to make sure in as we work to help our clients that we were also, you know, showing that we could master this ourselves and learn through that journey and take that personal journey that we had. And so we'll say we are still learning and growing. And this is not something that it's like, you know, one and done, or, you know, you reach this sort of point. It's like, because there's always aspects that we're working to continue to evolve. And that's having some fun with it at the end of the day. We've got, you know, we can laugh about ourselves and some of the challenges, and we can say, oh, look there, I've just slipped back into my, you know, my superhighway approach. And so it's just, again, I think that if we enjoy our own growth as human beings, it makes a huge difference for us. And we can really have some fun as we go through that process. It's challenging. It's out of our comfort zone, but, you know, it doesn't mean we need to sort of hunker down and protect ourselves from that experience.
I love it. No armchair quarterback happening for you guys. You guys have done the work. Where can people connect with you, Heather, and anyone that wants to just say, I want to get better at leadership. I want to get better at having a growth mindset, changing some of my thinking. Where's a good place to connect with y'all?
So our website, dranitsaris-hilliard.com, pretty much is the gateway to all of our materials, our books, our YouTube videos, our podcast, Dismantling Dysfunction, and all of our written works are there. So it's probably the easiest place to access what it is that we do and that how we help our clients.
And we'll absolutely link that in the show notes so everybody has that. Girls, it was wonderful. I literally could continue to ask questions, but we are out of time. Thank you. Thank you for the work you're doing. Thank you for sharing. Continue the amazing work. I love that it's a mother-daughter combo crushing it out there. So I really do. I appreciate you guys for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks. Thanks for the great conversation.
Yeah.
Well, remember, you guys, your mindset matters, and they gave a lot to think about. They gave some really, I think, intriguing, some provocative thought that we can dig into and say, how can we get better? So go check them out. I want you to go see their website because they've written some amazing work. They're helping a lot of clients. They're helping companies. They're helping individuals get better. So if you want to get better, great place to go. We will look forward to talking to you next time. Have an amazing day. Thank you so much for listening. If this content is delivering value to you, please make sure to subscribe, rate, and review us. That helps us build this community, and that is what we are all about. Building this community as big as we can, helping as many people as we can, and deliver as much value as possible. Be sure to head over to letsgowinpodcast.com for information on my coaching courses, and make sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Let's Go Win 365. Let's go win and transcend in life.
This is the Let's Go Win podcast with your host, J.M. Ryerson.